History has generally been the study of war and conquest. Empires rising and falling, armies marching across the pages of history, rulers who come and go, revolutions, the coups. These are the things of which history is made. That's generally what you read about. You read about who went to war with whom and when they did it. You read about one dynasty being overthrown and another coming to power. You read about revolutions. You read about the results of violence. Violence that in many cases has been brought about with the avowed purpose of producing peace. When you read the history of mankind, you read the story of man's wars. You read very little about peace. In fact, if you were to look at history, if you were to look at what has transpired, you would find that there are very few years of peace that have actually existed in the course of human history. Most of the years, there have been wars going on somewhere involving someone. Declared wars, undeclared wars, revolutions, you name it. Man has made many attempts to produce peace, and this is the avowed aim of many religions. They talk about peace, and yet when you study history, you find that probably more wars have been fought in the name of religion than any other one source, any other one reason. And so here we have the very thing that people say, well, this is going to produce peace, and yet it has often produced war. Now, there have been various attempts at peace, various human attempts. The Roman Empire sought to bring its own brand of peace to the world, a Pax Romana, the Peace of Rome, which was an attempt to at least bring a particular brand of peace. That did not endure. That didn't last. There were all kinds of upsurges and upsets and things that went on. During the course of that particular time period, collapsing with the barbarian invasions of the Heruli, the Vandals, the Ostrogoths, the final collapse of Rome, and then the attempt to resurrect a different Roman Empire, a so-called Holy Roman Empire that existed down through the Middle Ages. It was, again, an attempt to bring peace, to kind of provide an umbrella over the various nations of Europe, and to produce or provide some type of peace. Really, it didn't result in any. There were every kind of brutal war imaginable that swept Europe during that time period, not to mention wars that swept other areas elsewhere. In the aftermath of Napoleon, where a bloodbath had drenched Europe and had drenched the continent for many years, beginning with the French Revolution, continuing on through the time of Napoleon, And finally, in 1815, after just one upheaval after another, and after a period of 25, 30 years, there was an absence of peace, or 20, 25 years that there had just been virtually no peace there in the European continent, particularly in France, and many of the other nations had been drawn into it. There was an attempt. They had the Congress of Vienna, and they were going to bring about some form of peace. It didn't last. Many things came along to interrupt that. After World War I, which, if you remember, was to be the war to end all wars, we had the League of Nations. And the League of Nations, of course, was not the war to end all wars. It lasted until World War II came along. And then in the aftermath of World War II, we had the United Nations. And the United Nations has also proven unable to really do anything to bring world peace. So there is not peace when you look on the international level. When you look on the international horizon, we find right now, if you want to look in Africa, whether you want to look in Southern Africa and Angola, with its Cuban troops stationed there threatening to escalate its conflict with South Africa into a war, or whether you want to look at the bellicose dictator of Libya, who is going to, threatening that what he's going to do to the United States. Our, of course, having shot down a couple of these planes, we have problems now, even when you look in Asia, when you look at the continuing turmoil in Southeast Asia, or even a little bit of an uproar there in Korea. Around the world, you can look and you find various problems. And it's not just confined, this type of violence, this type of warfare, is not just confined to the international arena. It's not just something that goes on among nations. You know, violent, it's the kind of thing that we have to confront on the local level. Violent crime in this nation is at an all-time high. We have to confront that. We have to deal with that right here in this city where we live. We encounter the various problems, the various things that come along. So we see that continual talk about high crime rate, about the police department, about the prison system, about all of these things, and all the various methods by which man has sought to put a lid on things in society, and yet it seems only to grow worse. The violent crime in the nation rises from year to year. When we want to escape from all of this, and we turn to movies or television or novels, what do we find? Well, generally we find something that has a theme of murder and or violence. This makes up the primary theme of most of our attempts at escape. So you confront violence in the real world, you confront it in the imagined world, in the fiction, the world of fiction. You know, why? I think we ought to ask ourselves, is our society in general, human society, why is it so violent? Is violence an inevitable byproduct of human beings? Can there be peace among people? Why do we have the kind of violence, the kind of escalation of violence, both on the international, national, and local scenes? Still, the Bible talks about a time of peace and looks forward to a time of peace. How can something like that be brought about when, as we look at the record of history, we find that man has generally not had very much peace? We don't see the record of peace when we look at history. Well, I want us today to focus on another one of God's commandments and to come to understand a little more fully all of the ways in which this particular commandment governs our various actions, governs the things that we do and that we say, and understand the way in which there is going to be peace brought about, because there is a way that leads to peace. God says, the way of peace they know not. And when you look at our society, and when you look at man's various attempts to produce peace and to provide peace, man's way, you have to conclude, the way of peace they know not. Because if they know the way of peace, then why hasn't very much peace resulted? Well, we find man has tried various ways. Now, let's understand a little bit of where violence originated. Back in John chapter 8 and verse 44, Jesus Christ expounded the origin of a violent society. He told those that he was dealing with at that time, he said, "You are of your father, the devil, and the lust of your father you will do. He was a murderer from the beginning, and abode not in the truth, because there is no truth in him. When he speaks a lie, he speaks of his own, for he is a liar and the father of it." Now, who was Jesus Christ talking about? He said here in verse 44, "You are of your father the devil." Satan the devil, we're told here, was a murderer from the beginning. Now, in what way was Satan the devil a murderer from the beginning? Well, let's go back to the beginning and let's understand a little bit of the origin of violence in human society. Let's understand where it came from. Let's understand where it originated. Let's understand why it originated. Let's understand why it spread. Let's understand what God says can be done and will be done. Let's pick up the story in Genesis chapter 4. We find here that Adam knew Eve, his wife, and she conceived and bore Cain. And in verse 2, she again bore another son, Abel. Abel was a keeper of sheep, and Cain was a tiller of the ground. In the process of time, it came to pass that Cain brought of the fruit of the ground an offering unto the Eternal, and Abel he also brought of the firstlings of his flock, and of the fat thereof, and the Eternal had respect unto Abel unto his offering, but unto Cain unto his offering he had not respect. And Cain was very wroth, and his countenance fell. All right, now what transpired here? We find that there came Cain and Abel came before God to offer a sacrifice. We're told that Cain brought of the fruit of the ground. Now, there are a couple of things to understand here. Number one, it does not say that Cain brought of the first fruits of the ground, that Cain brought of the best of the fruits of the ground. We're told that Cain simply brought of the fruit of the ground. Well, he had a few old things laying around that weren't much good for anything else, so he might as well give it to God. Kind of the attitude that he expressed. Secondarily, to understand, there are two types of sacrifices. One was a thank offering, in which category Cain's sacrifice would fall. If we're going to, actually, Cain wasn't particularly thankful when he made the offering, but this was nevertheless the category that it would come under. But the other type of offering is a sin offering, an offering made for sin. And that, we're told, we're reminded back in the book of Hebrews, that without the shedding of blood, there is no remission of sin. So the sacrifice of an animal with its blood pouring out was a reminder of the sacrifice of Jesus Christ which was to come. Now, again, as Paul expounds in the book of Hebrews, that by the shedding of the blood of bulls and goats, there is no remission of sin. That was not the sacrifice that could atone for sin, but it looked forward to it. It represented it. It prefigured it. Abel recognized, we're told that Abel also brought of the firstlings of the flock. See, Abel brought a thank offering, but he also brought of the firstlings of the flock. He came to offer a sin offering. He recognized his need for a Savior. Cain did not. Cain brought a thank offering and was begrudging about that. Did not even bring the type there that he should have, and was not interested in his need for a Savior, did not recognize his need for a Savior. So we find that God had respect to Abel's offering, because God had respect to Abel's attitude. You know, God looks on the heart. We're told, Paul expounds the principle, the Lord loves a cheerful giver. You come before God, and what God is impressed with is not what you're bringing Him, because God doesn't need what you ask. See, He is the Lord High God, the possessor of heaven and earth. He says, all the gold is mine, all the silver is mine. The great God doesn't need what you and I have. God is not impressed with what you bring. God is impressed with the attitude. And He's impressed either in a positive or a negative vein with the attitude in which we come before Him. So because God had respect unto Abel, He had respect unto Abel's offering, but unto Cain and to his offering He had not respect. And what was Cain's attitude then? Cain was very wroth, and his countenance fell. He got mad. Got in a bad attitude, just written all over his face. Boy, you know, he didn't like that. And the Eternal said unto Cain, why are you wroth? Why is your countenance fallen? Cain, what are you in a bad attitude about? If you do well, shall you not be accepted? You know, Cain, look, I'm not playing favorites. It's not that I like Abel and I don't like you. If you do what you're supposed to do, you will be accepted just as much as he is. And if you don't do well, if you don't shape up, that's what he's saying, if you don't shape up, sin lies at the door, and unto you shall be its desire, but you shall rule over it. Now what it's saying is, look, if you don't do well, sin is lying at the door. It's there. and it's going to desire to pull you down. You've got to overcome it. You've got to master it. Well, that's what he's saying. You know, look, Cain, you better shape up. If you shape up, if you do what you ought to do, I'll be pleased with you. But you better watch it, because sin lies at the door, and if you don't get on top of things, it's going to pull you down and it's going to destroy you. Now, verse 8, Cain did not take heed to what God said. Cain talked with, or as the literal Hebrew is, spoke against, or challenged his brother Abel. And it came to pass that when they were in the field, Cain rose up against Abel, his brother, and slew him. Got so mad, he just, you know, knocked him in the head with something, killed him. A little later, the Eternal said unto Cain, where is Abel, your brother? Now, God knew where Abel was. God wanted to see what Cain would say. Haven't you ever done that to your children? You know, ask them a question, you already know the answer. You know, did you get into this, or did you get into the cookie jar, and here they got it smeared all across their face? You know what the answer is. You know who's in it. Did you do that? And, you know, they sit there and they answer. Maybe in some cases they're like Cain. They say, who, me? No, you know, you must have got me mixed up with somebody else. Wasn't me. And here, you know, got chocolate smeared all across her face or something. And can't understand how you knew. Well, God knew. But God wanted to see what Cain would say. And God said, look, Cain, where's your brother Abel? And he said, oh, I don't know. Am I my brother's keeper? You expect me to keep up with him all the time? How should I know? All right, that was all God wanted to know. And so then God said, what have you done? The voice of your brother's blood cries unto me from the ground. What do you mean? You're not his keeper. I know what you've done. Your brother's blood is crying out from the ground. You've murdered your brother, Cain. Now you're cursed from the earth, which has opened her mouth to receive your brother's blood. When you till the ground, it'll not yield to you her strength. A fugitive and a vagabond shall you be. What did Cain say then? Verse 13, Cain said, my punishment is greater than I can bear. Oh, woe is me. You sure are being unfair to me, God. You're really picking on me. Cain's attitude was not an attitude of repentance. It was an attitude of feeling sorry for himself. Why are you being so rough on me? You know, all I did was kill my brother. Why are you being so hard on me? He's going to banish me out here. Boy, that's terrible. So an attitude of absolute just self-pity, totally turned inward, totally concerned with self. So Cain goes on complaining in verse 14 that he's afraid somebody's going to kill him. And God tells him that a mark will be established or set up lest he be killed. Cain went out from the presence of the Eternal, dwelt in the land of Nod on the east of Eden, and then Cain's son Enoch was born at a later period of time. A city was built by the family of Cain, named the city of Enoch. And it goes on into the multiplication of the family of Cain. And as we know from secular history, from Josephus and others, the family of Cain in many ways dominated the history of the pre-flood world. That is a different subject, and I don't want to get off that. I could spend an entire sermon just on the history of the pre-flood world. Many interesting points to bring in, but the point that I want to focus on as we continue the story in Genesis 6, we find that the situation continued to deteriorate, and in verse 3, the Eternal said, my spirit shall not always strive with man, for he also is flesh, yet his days shall be 120 years. This is when God began to deal with Noah. He said, I'm going to give them 120 years to shape up, or I'm going to destroy them. He goes on and refers to the giants that were extant at that time. In verse 5, God saw the wickedness of man was great in the earth, that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And it repented the Eternal that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him at his heart. On down in verse 11, the earth also was corrupt before God, and the earth was filled with violence. Now, what had happened? What had happened? Violence started out. the spirit of murder began with Satan the devil. We're going to see very clearly defined. Well, let's go back. Let's notice before we go on the source of violence, the source of this type of an attitude, why Satan is called the first murderer. 1 John chapter 3 in verse 11. For this is the message that you heard from the beginning, that you should love one another, not as Cain, who was of that wicked one, of Satan the devil, and slew his brother. And why did he slay him? Why did Cain slay Abel? Because his own works were evil, and his brother's righteous. Cain hated Abel. Why? Because Abel made him look bad. That's why. That's what it simply and basically boiled down to. Cain felt like, Abel, you make me look bad. You know, God's down on me, and God wouldn't be so down on me if it weren't for you. But you go around looking good and doing all the things you ought to do, and you make me look bad. Now, Cain didn't stop to consider that Cain is the one that made Cain look bad. He didn't take Abel around. But Cain resented Abel because Abel made him look bad, and he hated him. Now, that spirit, that attitude of hatred, of resentment, is the attitude of Satan the devil. That's why he's called a murderer from the beginning, because he had the spirit and the attitude of murder, of hatred. Now, what happened? Cain perpetrated a murder. God banished him into the land of Nod. The family of Cain multiplied, and at a later period in the history of the human family, the family of Cain re-invaded, came back into the area there where the rest of the family was living. The family began to multiply very rapidly. A city was built, an attempt to, as Josephus brings out, that Cain and his family sought to augment their wealth by violence, by robbery, by everything conceivable. Cain established a society. He established a civilization, if you will, centered there in the pre-flood city of Enoch. And we find that the attitude of that society very rapidly rubbed off on other people. Until, as we come down to the statement there in Genesis 6:11, the earth was filled with violence. There was a contaminating effect. God was allowing a certain record to be written, and we'll notice a little later. You see, God could have done something else. God could have executed Cain right away if he wanted to. God did not. He allowed a record to be written. He allowed a lesson to be established and learned. The family of Cain multiplied. And as the family of Cain multiplied, the way of Cain multiplied. The way of Cain, and the very word Cain means get. And that is the way of Cain, the way of get. The way of get for self at all costs. An absolute selfish, self-centered way. And as the way of Cain multiplied, violence filled the earth. And the earth became absolutely polluted and contaminated with an attitude of violence and hatred, until the point came that the only way to deal with it was for God to simply wipe humanity off the face of the map and start over again with the family of Noah. So we see a multiplication of the problem as conditions continued to deteriorate in the pre-flood world. Now, we see 1 John chapter 3 gives us a reason as to why. It explains to us where did murder come from? Well, there was an attitude here. An attitude of resentment, of hatred. Now, let's notice in James chapter 4. James chapter 4, Verse 1. A little more is expounded. From whence come wars and fightings among you? Where do wars come from? Where do fighting, where do strife and violence come from? Come they not hence, even of your lust, that war in your members? You lust and have not. You kill and desire to have, and cannot obtain. You fight in war, yet you have not because you ask not. You ask and receive not because you ask amiss that you may consume it upon your lust. So we're here told that unlawful desire, an attitude of envy, is the source of a lot of violence, the source of war. People seeing what someone else has and they want it. Maybe it's territory, maybe it's whatever. You know, where do wars come from? They come from envy. And notice back in verse 14 of James 3. But if you have bitter envying and strife in your hearts, glory not, and lie not against the truth. This wisdom descends not from above, but is earthly, sensual, devilish. Now, this is the kind of thinking that proceeds from Satan the devil. Twice called a murderer from the beginning. Bitter envying and strife. That type of an attitude is devilish. For where envying and strife is, there is confusion and every evil work. But the wisdom that is from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, easy to be entreated, full of mercy and good fruit, without partiality and hypocrisy. And the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace of them that make peace. So there is a way of peace, and there is a way of warfare, of strife, and of violence that is begotten from envy, from strife, from hatred, from resentment. The kind of an attitude that Cain engendered. The kind of an attitude that multiplied, as the family of Cain multiplied, because Cain multiplied his own way. And there was a strife and a violence that came to fill the earth. And the result was eventually a total destruction that God brought on the earth at that time. Now, God's law on the subject is very, very simple and very, very plain. Very, very simple, short sentence. One of the shortest verses in the Bible. Exodus chapter 20, verse 13. Solution to the whole problem. Very simply written, thou shalt not kill. Or as it could also be rendered, you shall do no murder. That would probably be a more accurate translation from the original. You shall not kill. You shall do no murder. Very simple statement. Very plain. Solve a multitude of problems. Now let's get into understanding a little more fully what that means. We come on down in Exodus 21, and we find, for instance, in Exodus 21:12, he that smites a man so that he die shall be surely put to death. Now here we find that there was a death penalty that was to be enforced. Yet we just got through reading, you shall not kill. Now what is this talking about? Well, let's understand, let's maybe tie some things together in regards to this particular commandment of God, and let's understand a little bit of what God actually meant and the results in society. Now, there was a change that took place after the flood. Prior to the flood, Cain killed Abel. God did not execute Cain. He banished him. Cain, needless to say, did not stay banished. When his family multiplied, he eventually came back in. Was very instrumental in terms of the establishment of this world civilization in the pre-flood world. Now, the result was that violence multiplied until it filled the earth. After the flood, God gave instructions to Noah that are recorded in Genesis chapter 9 and verse 5. Surely your blood of your lives will I require. At the hand of every beast will I require it, and at the hand of man. At the hand of every man's brother will I require the life of man. Whoso sheds man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed, for in the image of God made he man. You, be you fruitful and multiply, bring forth abundantly in the earth and multiply therein. God said here in Genesis 9:6, whoso sheds man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed, for in the image of God made he man. God is saying here that human life has a sanctity. Human life means something. Human life is not to be taken cheaply, not to be treated cheaply. Now, what was the result of not executing Cain? Well, the result was that eventually violence filled the earth. Now, that is expounded back, the reason for that is expounded back in Ecclesiastes 8 and verse 11. Ecclesiastes 8:11. Because sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, therefore the heart of the sons of men is fully set in them to do evil. Because sentence against an evil work is not speedily executed, the heart of men is fully set in them to do evil. People think they can get by with it. Now, God had allowed that record to be recorded, the history of the pre-flood world. What happens when something is not instituted, when there is no civil government instituted among men? What happens is that violence and anarchy fills the earth. And the violent prey on others, and people become violent in response, and violence fills the earth. And so God had established that human life was to have sanctity, and that anyone, human beings, did not have the right to kill other human beings, and that there was to be civil government established to execute that individual who would perpetrate murder. This is further brought out in the book of Romans chapter 13, verse 1. Let every soul be subject unto the higher power. For there is no power but of God, and the powers that be are ordained of God. Whosoever, therefore, resists the power, resists the ordinance of God. And they that resist shall receive to themselves judgment. For rulers are not a terror to good works, but to the evil. Will you then not be afraid of the power to do that? Will you not then be afraid of the power? You won't be afraid of the power? Do that which is good, and you shall have praise of the same. For he is the minister of God to you for good. But if you do that which is evil, be afraid, for he bears not the sword in vain. For he is the minister of God, a revenger, to execute wrath upon him that does evil. Wherefore, you must needs be subject, not only for wrath, but also for conscience' sake. For this cause, pay you tribute also, pay taxes. For they are God's ministers, attending continually upon this very thing. Render, therefore, to all their dues, tribute to whom tribute is due, custom to whom custom, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor. We are told here as Christians, and understand, Paul is writing to the church at Rome, the seat of the Roman Empire. You think our government is corrupt? The government of Nero would have paled our government into almost insignificance when you talk in terms of corruption. Nero was one of the most degenerate and corrupt individuals that ever ruled the Roman Empire. He was the emperor at the time Paul wrote. Paul was writing to the church in Rome, and he told them, even living in that circumstance, he said, look, you be subject to the higher powers. You obey the law. There is a reason why civil government exists, and God will bring into judgment those who occupy those offices. They will have to give an account, because we're told in the book of Daniel very plainly that God sets over nations whomsoever he will, sometimes even the basest of men. There is a responsibility that they have. The responsibility of civil government was to be a you know, in that sense, a representative for God, a revenger to execute wrath upon him that does evil. You see exactly what God had told Noah. There was to be sanctity given to human life. It was to be respected. Violence was not to be allowed to breed and multiply and fill the earth. It was, and the only way that it could be dealt with was to be cut off very speedily. Now, the result, of course, is that that is not the way. You see, man originally did not want God's government. And God said, all right, if you're not going to have my government, then there is going to have to be certain government executed among men by men. There has got to be certain standards of civil government. There has got to be something less anarchy, violence, and chaos fill the earth and prevent anything from being able to function, prevent a life from being able to be lived in any kind of normal manner. And so God decreed to Noah, and it was decreed therefore to the human family and through Noah to the human family, to his children, and that standard came down that there is to be regarded a sanctity of human life. And so every society that basically regarded murder as a capital crime. Now, the problem, of course, has been that there has not been a universal or a fair application. Generally, exceptions have been made. You find that some societies have been much more violent than others. A society that tolerates violence begets violence. A society that tolerates violence, therefore condones it, cheapens human life. And the result is, of course, that we find ourselves getting into the situation that Jesus Christ prophesied. He said, as it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be also in the days of the coming of the Son of Man. We find ourselves in a situation that is very closely paralleling the situation in the days of Noah. We find violence filling the earth. We find our society characterized by, we don't find justice with equity. We don't find a right standard of justice in our society. And we find that violence is tolerated. Violence is not merely tolerated, it is condoned. And it is glorified. And we are reaping the consequences and the results. When you go through Exodus 21, you find the laws that God gave Israel as a civil nation. They were a civil nation. They were not merely a church. They were also a civil nation, and God therefore gave them civil laws. These were laws to be used among human beings to regulate human conduct. So we find civil law that was given. The sanctity of human life was to be recognized. One of the purposes for which civil governments were authorized among men, and God allows them to hold sway. We're told no power, there is no power but of God. In other words, whatever civil powers, whatever human governments exist because God allows them. And God allows them for the purpose of maintaining order. And they are doing a rather poor job and will be held accountable for the same. Now, we see that there was an application in the Old Testament, that there was an application of that commandment, and that there was sanctity given to human life. That God recognized, God said the basis of all of this was that human beings were made in His image. And the life of a human being was to mean something. Now, God was dealing with Israel strictly on a physical basis. And He dealt with them in that way. And He dealt with them in physical terms. And He dealt with them on the basis of physical government. Jesus Christ expanded and expounded the commandments of God. He did not come to do away with the commandments of God. He made it very plain in Matthew chapter 5 that He did not come to do away with the law or the prophets, but rather to fill them up to the very full, to expand them. Therefore, we read in Matthew chapter 5 and verse 9, Jesus Christ said, blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. Jesus Christ did not say that it was enough simply to refrain from committing murder. Jesus Christ said, you are to be a peacemaker. Not simply enough to refrain from carrying out the act of murder, but to be a peacemaker. Let's notice on down a little further in Matthew 5, in verse 43. You have heard that it has been said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say unto you, love your enemy. Bless them that curse you. Do good to them that hate you and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you, that you may be the children of your Father which is in heaven. For he makes his sun to rise on the evil and on the good, and sends rain on the just and on the unjust. If you love them which love you, what reward have you? Don't even the publicans the same? If you salute your brethren only, what do you more than others? Do not even the publicans so? Be you therefore perfect, even as your Father which is in heaven is perfect. Jesus Christ said, look, you as a Christian need to have the mind and the attitude of God, the great God who so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son. The great God who manifested his love toward us while we were yet sinners. Christ died for us. God did not give his love to us because we earned it or deserved it. Because somehow we were so outstanding that God looked down and had, you know, this attitude toward us. We're told, love your enemies. It's not enough just to love your friends. You know, everybody does that. Christ said, even the publicans do that. You know, the crooks do that. Everybody loves their buddies. You do something nice and they like you for it. They treat you well. You know, you have a certain amount of camaraderie between people who are allied together in some evil device or something that they're up to. People deal with their friends. You know, they treat their friends well. Christ said, look, if that's all you do, then you're not really doing anything. You're not doing anything any more than anyone else does. We are required to go over and above the attitude that we can find extant in the world. We're required here, love your enemies. You know, have a right desire for them. Pray for them. Don't have an attitude of hatred and vindictiveness. Notice back in Matthew 5, verse 21. You have heard that it was said by them of old time, you shall not kill. We read a little earlier, Exodus 20, verse 13. And whosoever shall kill shall be in danger of the judgment. That was brought out in Exodus 21. But I say unto you, so now Christ is expanding, and he's not doing away with it. He is expanding the letter of the law to the spirit of the law. Understanding that the spirit of the law goes way beyond the letter. Christ didn't do away with the law. He magnified the law. He expanded it out to be far more inclusive. I say unto you that whosoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. And whosoever shall say to his brother, Raca, which is an expression of just absolute derision and contempt, shall be in danger of the council. But whosoever shall say, you fool, shall be in danger of Gehenna fire. Now, the term here, you fool, was a more powerful term in the original. It meant an individual of absolute, total worthlessness. You're telling somebody, you are absolutely, you're not worth anything. You know, you are a contemptible person. And an expression of hatred. What you're doing, you're expressing absolute hatred. This is the sense of the original. The term, you fool, does not really fully convey in English the power of the original statement. What Christ is saying is if you have that kind of an attitude toward another human being, if you have an attitude of absolute hatred toward someone else, then you are in danger of Gehenna fire. Therefore, if you bring your gift to the altar and there remember that your brother has aught against you, leave there your gift before the altar, go your way, first be reconciled to your brother, then come and offer your gift. he goes on to say, agree with your adversary quickly while you're in the way with him, lest at any time the adversary deliver you to the judge deliver you to the officer and you be cast into prison. Truly I say unto you, you shall by no means come out thence until you pay the uttermost farthing. So Christ very clearly summed up the legal profession and the way it works. It hasn't changed a whole lot. He said, look, you better not get tangled up with somebody in some long drawn out legal thing. Needham shuts up his bowels of compassion. From him, how dwells the love of God in him? My little children, let us not love in word, neither in tongue, but in deed and in truth. Now, we're told here that hatred is the spirit of murder. If you have hatred toward someone, that is the spirit of murder. And according to the definition that John gives here in 1 John 3:15, if you have hatred, you hate someone, then you are a murderer. And no murderer has eternal life abiding in him. You can't get into God's kingdom with an attitude of hatred toward someone. That is the total antithesis of the way of God. God is love. God's way is love. John goes on and further expounds, it is not enough just simply to refrain from killing someone. You have to, on the other hand, actively show love. Do good. Be helpful. Do what you can when you can. You know, this is the way we perceive. This is the way we comprehend the love of God. How do you really grasp and understand the love God has toward you? Well, the fact that He laid down His life for us. You know, that is what enables us to comprehend the love God has toward us. Because He gave Himself as a sacrifice for us. All right, we're told, therefore, that we ought to demonstrate love toward one another by laying down our lives for one another, giving of ourselves. How do we do that? If we have something, if you are blessed by God where you have this world's good, you see your brother in need, and there's a difference between maybe what he needs and what he wants. It's not a matter of God saying that you ought to, you know, you have to give everything you have to somebody else. He says, if you see someone that really is in need and you're in a position to help them, then you ought to have an attitude of wanting to help them. Of not just holding on and saying, well, boy, I'm not going to give anybody anything. We're not just to love in word or in tongue, you know, just by saying the words. That's easy. God says love in deed and in truth. The very opposite of a spirit of hatred is the spirit of love. And it is to be reflected by the way we live, the way we act, by what we do. That is the spirit of the commandment in Exodus 20, verse 13. You shall do no murder. You shall have no hatred toward someone else. Now, let's further understand. We see here the basic spirit of God's law brought out. Let's understand a little bit more as to how some of these things, how the commandment against murder applied, how it applied to the nation of civil Israel, and how it applies to us today as Jesus Christ expanded it. Now, you read in the Old Testament, or as I began in the beginning of the sermon, I mentioned that when you read the story of history, you read the story of war and of conquest. Now, when you read the Bible, you read of war. You read of warfare that took place. You read the book of Judges, which is undoubtedly the bloodiest book in the entirety of the Bible, a book that is filled with the story of warfare and of violence and of all kinds of things. Number one to understand is the Bible contains a record of what happened, not merely what God wished to happen. It contains a record of what occurred. Not necessarily of what should have occurred. Now, the reason the book of Judges contains the incidents that it does is clearly summed up in the last verse of the book of Judges. Back in Judges 21:25, last verse. In those days there was no king in Israel. Every man did that which was right in his own eyes. Everybody was doing his own thing. That's why. Judges contains a record of what happened when everybody did his own thing. when everybody did what he wanted to do, and there was not an organized, effective central government that was exercising control over the conduct of the people. So we have a story that really ought to further enforce in our minds the fact that, you know, it's a lot better for people to let God direct their steps than for them to try and direct their own in their own way. Now, what about warfare in the Old Testament? What about the wars in which ancient Israel was involved? Notice the principle that God gave them in Exodus 14 and verse 14. Exodus 14, verse 14. The Eternal shall fight for you, and you shall hold your peace. Now understand something. God is the giver of life. God is the creator and the giver of life. As the owner of everything and as the giver of life, God has the right to take life, because life belongs to God. God is the source of life. But that is a right that God reserves to himself. You know, there are those that don't deserve to live. They have forfeited that right by the way that they have conducted themselves, and God will deal with them accordingly. See, God does not give everyone an intrinsic right to life forever. The wages of sin is death. The gift of God is eternal life. There are wages. There are things that people earn for what they've done, and that's death. God has the right to take life because God is the author of life. Life emanates out from God. God is the source of life. God told Israel of old, look, you hold your peace, I will fight for you. I will take care of what needs to be done. I will deal with these various nations and these various tribes and peoples. I will bring it about. There are many places where it was stated when Israel was getting ready to come into the Promised Land, God told them in Deuteronomy 1:30, the Eternal your God, which goes before you, he shall fight for you according to all that he did for you in Egypt before your eyes. Many other places. Deuteronomy 3:22, you shall not fear them, for the Eternal your God, he shall fight for you. Well, there are various places that we could go in the book of Deuteronomy and in the book of Exodus and others that explain what God promised and what God told Israel they could receive. Now that is not, again, that is not the story of the way things went. That is a story of the way things could have gone. Israel, of course, was not always the one doing the fighting. We find many times that Israel was the one doing the fighting. Now, there is a reason as to why that took place, and that reason is explained in Exodus 17. Exodus 17 and verse 7. He, Moses, called the name of the place Massah and Meribah because of the chiding of the children of Israel. And because they tempted the Eternal, saying, here's the way they tempted God, saying, is the Lord among us or not? Notice the very next thing that happened. Then came Amalek and fought with Israel in Rephidim. And Moses said unto Joshua, choose us out men and go out and fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand on the top of the hill with the rod of God in my hand. Israel did not believe the promises God made. Israel tempted God, saying, well, we don't know whether God's going to do what he said or not. God said, all right. You know, you don't want to believe me. You don't want to put your trust in me. Fine, go to it. There they are. Israel fought and warred. God used them as an instrument to accomplish what he was intending on doing, what God would have accomplished in another way. But because of Israel's lack of faith, because of their attitude, God allowed them to fight wars. God allowed Israel to do many things that were not in his plan and purpose, in the sense that it was the best thing to do, but God allowed it. He allowed them to choose. He allowed them to lack faith. He allowed many of them to die in the wilderness because of some of their attitude. But Jesus Christ explained a little more fully the attitude we are to have as Christians. In John 18:36, as he was on trial for his life before Pilate, Jesus answered, "My kingdom, my government, my nation, the kingdom of which I am the representative, of which I am the king, is not of this world. It is not a part of this world's society. It is not one of this world's competing nations. If my kingdom were of this world, if it were a part of this world's government, then would my servants fight that I should not be delivered to the Jews. If my government, my kingdom, were one of this world's government, then I would have an army out here. My servants would fight in this world's wars if my kingdom were of this world. But now is my kingdom not from hence." Jesus Christ said his kingdom, his government, is not one of this world's competing governments. If it were, then would his servants fight like the servants of other governments? But we don't. Now, notice on back in 2 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 4, or verse 3. "For though we walk in the flesh, though we live as physical human beings, alive and functioning in a physical society, though we walk in the flesh, we do not war in the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, they're not physical. But they are mighty through God to the pulling down of strongholds." We're not taking part in this world's fighting and violence and wars. We're not taking part in that. We have been called to a higher and greater calling. God allows the world to go its course. He allows the world to fight its wars. God has instituted certain civil government among human beings, and God rules in the affairs of men. He allows these things, and he has instituted and decreed that there be such in terms of civil government, and will hold those who occupy those offices accountable for the way in which they have conducted themselves. We have been called to a different calling. We have been called, as Paul explained, to be ambassadors for Christ. We have been called as representatives of the government of God, the kingdom of God, of what the gospel of Jesus Christ was all about, the good news of the coming kingdom of God, to demonstrate as a light to the world the attitude of Jesus Christ. Part of that attitude is expressed in Romans chapter 12. Let's notice some instructions that are given to us. Romans 12 and verse 18. "If it be possible, as much as lies within you, live peaceably with all men." Now, this recognizes that you can live peaceably with some people a little more successfully than you can with others. Namely, because you can, while you can control your actions, you can't always control theirs. So if it be possible, as much as lies within you, live peaceably with all men. "Dearly beloved, avenge not yourselves." Don't have an attitude of vengeance. "Well, I'm going to get even with you. I'm going to fix you." "Avenge not yourselves, but rather give place unto wrath. Let something else take its place. For it is written that vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Eternal." God is a just God. You know, there isn't a free ride. What a man sows, that shall he also reap. "Therefore, if your enemy hunger, feed him. If he thirst, give him drink. For in so doing, you shall heap coals of fire on his head. Be not overcome of evil, but overcome evil with good." Now, this is God's instruction as to how we are to deal with people as individuals. This is spoken to individual Christians. God is not intervening in the civil governments and affairs of this world. The time will come when he shall. This is talking to us as individuals as to how we as individuals should conduct our affairs. We should live peaceably, not having an attitude of vengeance, being willing to feed you know, or feed our enemy, or give him something to drink. I mean, having an attitude of compassion on somebody. Somebody does you dirty, and all of a sudden he's in need. What are you going to do? Say, boy, you know, you're going to get it now. Well, God says, look, have an attitude. Be willing to help. Be not overcome of evil, but overcome evil with good. So don't have an attitude of avenging yourself. Now, let's notice again a little bit more of the spirit of this law brought out back in the book of Proverbs. We've seen here that an attitude of envy, an attitude of hatred is forbidden, that we are not to take human life, that that is not our prerogative. Human life, God says, is to have a certain sanctity, a certain value. We're not to avenge ourselves. We're not to give rise to an attitude of hatred. We see that there are instructions even regarding civil government and warfare and the way in which His God's servants should act in light of these things. Now, notice back in Proverbs 18:21, something that ties in with the spirit of the law of this commandment. Death and life are in the power of the tongue, and they that love it shall eat the fruit thereof. Death and life are in the power of the tongue. You know, you can kill someone by slander, by killing their reputation. You can demonstrate the spirit of murder by what you say about someone else and be just as guilty of breaking the sixth commandment as if you were to go pick up a gun and blast them away. Just as guilty in God's sight. It says death and life are in the power of the tongue. You know, what you say about someone can have a terrific impact. And all the, again, the spirit of murder. Generally, slander is motivated by hatred, by envy, by the very same motives, the very same characteristics that motivated murder, that motivated Cain to kill Abel. We talk about character assassination. We even use the term, realizing that you have, in effect, committed murder. Maybe you lack the guts to pick up a gun and shoot him, so you shot him down by what you said. Well, as far as God is concerned, it's the same thing, and you'll pay the same penalty if you don't repent of it. You know, it's a matter that not only do we have a society that is filled with violence, we make a game out of it. We teach our children to pretend to do all of these acts, and then we're amazed when they actually carry it out. We make entertainment out of violence. God says in Proverbs chapter 14 and verse 9, fools make a mock at sin, but among the righteous there is favor. God doesn't see anything funny about sin. God does not think sin is the stuff of which entertainment should be made. And He makes a very plain, very plain statement. Fools make a mock at sin. Make a game out of it. That's what make a mock at. Just, you know, play at it. Pretend at it. It is a very foolish thing to do. That's not the way of God, you know, just very plainly stated. Let's notice back in Micah chapter 4. Now, we live in a violent society. There's going to come a time when violence will not fill the earth. Notice Micah chapter 4. In verse 1, in the last days it shall come to pass that the mountain of the house of the Eternal shall be established in the top of the mountains, and it shall be exalted above the nations, and people shall flow into it. And many nations shall come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Eternal, to the house of the God of Jacob, and He will teach us of His way. Talking about when Jesus Christ is going to come back and establish His government on this earth. In verse 3, Christ shall judge among many people and rebuke strong nations afar off, and they shall beat their swords into plowshares, their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. War is something that needs to be learned. War won't be learned anymore. God is not going to allow the world to learn war in the world tomorrow. I think, again, that needs to be our attitude of putting that into practice, even in our own homes and our own families. And are we practicing and putting into practice the things that God is going to put into practice in the world tomorrow, the things that supposedly we are in training, the government that we are in training to learn how to carry out, to be a part of? Do we learn war anymore? Do we feed our minds on a diet of violence and allow our children to grow up satiated by this kind of thing, where they make sport of it? We're not putting into practice what God has called us to put into practice if we allow that. How are we going to teach something if we're not practicing it? Neither shall they learn war anymore. Let's notice one final scripture back in Isaiah 32 that kind of ties some of it together. Isaiah 32, verse 1, "Behold, a king shall reign in righteousness, and princes shall rule in judgment." Now that's talking about when Jesus Christ rules the earth, and the saints rule under him. "A king shall reign in righteousness." What is righteousness? Psalm 119, verse 172 says, "All thy commandments are righteousness." Jesus Christ is going to rule in accordance with the law of God. "And princes shall reign in judgment." Justice with equity. Judging righteous judgment. Verse 2, "A man shall," in that time, in that day, in that society, "a man shall be as a hiding place from the wind and a covert from the tempest, as rivers of water in a dry place, as the shadow of a great rock in a weary land." You know, today, you see a stranger and you're scared of what? You know, you're scared to have much dealings with him. Most of you, if you're very wise, you wouldn't think about just stopping and picking up a hitchhiker somewhere along the way. No, there's every type of murder and theft and robbery and rape and every kind of violent, evil thing that takes place. We lock our doors up. Maybe we have two or three locks on our doors. We have bars on our windows. We install burglar alarms. We have patrols. You know, many of the subdivisions here in the city have only one or two entrances and exits where it's kind of difficult, you know, they can to try to control who comes in and out. And maybe there are nightly watch patrols that go up and down. We live in fear. We live in fear of the stranger that we might encounter. You teach your children, no, you don't go up and talk to a stranger. You certainly don't get in the car with a stranger. You know, a stranger tries to entice you into the car, you get out of there. We teach our children things like that. No, don't take things from strangers. You don't take candy from a stranger because you don't know what might be in it. You know, every year around Halloween, there's always a few stories that come out in the paper of some horrible, just demonic type thing some individual did. You know, put everything from putting razor blades in apples to lacing candy with strychnine or rat poison or something. God says in that time, in that society, you see a stranger and he's going to be a welcome sight. A man will be as a hiding place from the wind, as a covert from the tempest. You know, you have a problem, boy, you know, any stranger, anybody, you'd be glad to see him. He'd be glad to see you. He'll be a welcome sight. The kind of, just like a river of water in a dry place. You're going along and you see a stranger out there, you see somebody, and it'll be like seeing an old friend. It'll be a welcome sight. There won't be fear of violence that regulates the society, because a king shall reign in righteousness and princes shall rule in judgment. Coming on down here in verse 15, "Until the Spirit be poured upon us from on high, the wilderness be a fruitful field, and the fruitful field be counted for a forest. Then judgment shall dwell in the wilderness, and righteousness remain in the fruitful field, and the work of righteousness." And what is righteousness? Again, "all thy commandments are righteousness." Psalm 119, verse 172. That is what makes up and constitutes righteousness, obedience to the law of God, which is based on the love of God. You know, God is love. The great commandments, Christ summed it up. Love God with all your heart, love your neighbor as yourself. The Ten Commandments further expound and amplify How do you love God and how do you love your neighbor? The sixth commandment tells us in a very important way how do you love your neighbor? By refraining from violence, from hatred, from envy against him, from murder and the spirit of murder. The work of righteousness shall be peace. And the effect of that righteousness shall be quietness and assurance forever. My people shall dwell in a peaceable habitation and in sure dwellings and in quiet resting places. Peace is the result of obeying the law of God. God says of human beings, the way of peace they know not. There is a way that seems right unto a man, but the ends thereof are the ways of death. God says, commit your ways unto the eternal, and he will direct your path. He will bring it to pass. God's law, you shall do no murder. Amplified by Jesus Christ to say, you shall not even harbor the spirit of murder, of envy, of hatred. You shall love everyone. Showing forth that attitude, that kindness, that compassion that is the love of God, that is the effect of the law of God, the very mind of God. We are able to have that and to enjoy the fruits of it, the results of it in our lives and among ourselves right now. And the time is coming when we will be able to bring the effect of righteousness, peace to the whole world.